All right, dude. Now this is when we go random. You ready for this?
This
is, I'm going to give you some quotes from your book, right? Either quotes that you quoted or quotes that, you know, that you wrote. And then I want you just to riff on it. All right.
All right.
Just
let's go.
Just tell me what comes up.
Here I need a beat. No, let's go.
All right. Listen, if I was quicker. All right. I am not who I think I am. I am not what you think I am. I am what I think you think I am.
Boy, oh boy. So that was sitting on my 10th grade English teacher's podium every day. It was sitting in the front. She gave no explanation. And it was written by, and it said anonymous. And I always sat in the front. So I would stare at this thing and look at it. And it just, it messed with me hard. Because it really just spoke to the way in which we put on a facade for others. And in doing that, we oftentimes find ourselves defining ourselves by what other people think about us. So we start to operate in that feeling of, well, this is what other people think about me. So therefore, I guess that's who I am. I am not what I think I am. I am not what you think I am. I am what I think that you think I am. That'll mess with you forever.
Still, dude, I love that. I love that, man. And you know what? So a couple things come to my head. First, right, self-fulfilling prophecies, right? I lie. I lie to my kids, my own personal kids, my flesh and blood. I lie to them all the time. You know, and I think most parents do, because we tell kids that they could do things that they can't do or they can't do yet. Because we want them to get in the mind frame that they're going to do it. So we're going to be the first ones, right? And I think we can look at that statement from the positive or negative, right? Cool. So your teachers, as a teacher, first, I lie to some of my kids and I tell them that they could do this and we're going to do it. And knowing full well that right at this moment, they're unable to do it, but we will help them along and really giving them that idea that you're going to. Right. So good.
And or we lie to them because we are also continuing to feed them the false narrative of individualism and meritocracy, knowing that there's also systemic things that may oppose them in their efforts. And if we don't give them that whole story, then we're doing them sort of a disservice. Like, you can be anything when you grow up. Well, unless, you know, all of these other blockers that currently exist, right, will prevent you from doing that no matter how hard you work. That becomes a bigger part of the conversation.
Yeah, and that was the flip side, right? So we got the side of the teacher being positive, right? They are going to keep telling their kids, you're going to be able to do this, you're going to be able to do this. I've lied to kids and made them think that I like them. And I really don't like them that much. They're just not that likable. I mean,
is this confession time?
No, but my point is because I want you to think that you are X, Y, and Z. Like, I can't let you know this because that's the whole thing. Like, I want you to think that I think that you are fantastic because that makes you in turn become fantastic. Right. Which is the flip side.
You got me second guessing.
But no. But that's only one, because we know what really happens most of the time. Right. Because I'm a different cat, because I work on this. I've spent so much time making sure that my actions are correct in the eyes of children, because I ask them from feedback all the time. But on the flip side, right, where you get the teacher who tells the kid, you're not going to be nothing, who doesn't give the kid energy in the back, who seems to have their head down, who doesn't. So I'm not even trying to get this toxic positivity, like everything's great. I'm saying, like, it's literally that double-edged sword. Like, we as teachers can will you to greatness. And I'm not saying me, I know that's Savior, but I'm saying multiple teachers together can make you something that you might not even think. But when you go, oh, well, they think that I could do this. Well, not why can't I? Maybe I can do it. I didn't know, but they should know. So I feel like with that thought, that like both of those hit me at the exact same time with that. All right, next one. Here we go. You define social interactionism as a concept that explains that we navigate the world hoping others see us in a certain way so we can get what we want.
Yep.
Talk to me about this. What are we navigating? What facades are we putting on? What are we doing? And yeah, really, what are we trying to gain?
Yeah. Okay. All right. So I feel like I need to set this up clearly just to know. So my undergrad and graduate work was both in sociology of education. I was highly intrigued with social theory. And there are three prominent social theory frameworks that exist. One is functionalism. Everything will work out in the end over time. There's conflict theory, right? Which is why we have lots of debate over when you hear that word conflict and critical race theory. Anyway, so conflict theory, there's always opposition between the haves and the have-nots. The have-nots are always trying to get with the haves, and the haves are always trying to suppress the have-nots so that they can keep what they got. Okay, that's a nutshell. Then there's social interactionism. And by the way, any good faith sociologist believes that all of these things are at play at different points in different ways. So no one is like, I am a this theorist, but these are different theories that were introduced. So social interactionism is the most fascinating to me because it's the one that's much more personal and individualistic. It's a part in the social sciences, but social psychology give a lot of explanation to it as well as sociologists. And that is to say, I can power play in certain contexts because I have that power in certain contexts. So an example I remember that one of my professors gave was like a doctor may on their ward run the whole show, right? Every nurse, every medic, anybody who comes in that setting all have to defer to that person. He is the most, and I'm also utilizing the sexist language intentionally in this regard, right? He is the most powerful person within that, on that floor. And he's regarded as such. He owns that power. He knows he has that power. But that same doctor, if he goes downstairs to the McDonald's that is in the children's hospital ward and then stands in line and there is a 16-year-old young woman who is there taking orders and he mouths off at her, he should know better because she could help teacher spit in his food, right? So who holds the power in that sort of setting, right? Like he got to stand in line like the rest of them. He's got to, show a different, he's got to defer in that setting. But the deal is that, so social interactionism is that we all sort of know that those things are going on. So we kind of power play in certain contexts, like, oh, who has the authority, who has that badge on them, who is respected, who's well-regarded, and how can I potentially get that, or where can I be in a place where I have that? Because with authority comes the opportunity to get what I want. And so it's either getting that authority and then using that authority to get what I want, or leaning on the people that we know have the authority, being in their good graces to get what I want. But at the end of it, it's all about, I need to get something. And I recognize the only way to get it is through the vehicle of power.
Nice. All right. Next up, this is what I love. Some of us learn radical things in early childhood development and physiology classes, such as the effect of sunlight, color, and movement on the brain. So you don't have to talk about movement because we are well-versed in movement. We have Dr. Rady in our field. Man is a legend. He will tell you all about movement, all about BDNF. I mean, we are good with movement. Talk to me about sunlight and color, though. I thought that was super interesting.
Well, okay, so we do learn these things, and we know these things from neuroscience. And really, if anyone has... it was interesting. So I was a lateral entry teacher, but I took several education classes because I was focusing on sociology of education. And then I know like people like my wife, who was a teaching fellow, right? Like learned a whole lot more than I did. Also, I did do some other undergrad work in education. So I don't want to like downplay my experience in that regard, but nonetheless, early childhood development is something that's introduced and recognizing how sunlight affects our mood and how movement also affects our learning, how color and color association. We know like prisons are painted certain colors on purpose in order to sedate the people that are there, right? You walk into, the example that I always think about is if you walk into a K through two classroom, you see all of those things, you see vibrancy, right? And you hear it, you feel it. All of the senses are engaged. And we know that that's how learning is done best, right? So I'm going to sing this song. We're going to do a movement to it. We have colors that are going on, right? We're going to have like all of those things. But as we matriculate into higher levels of education, we slowly but surely, I should say actually quickly, we begin to strip away every single one of those things, right? And so we cinder block walls and fluorescent lights. We remove, it's a negotiable if there's natural light, if we have students even go outside, you know, how important, if a student is misbehaving, what's the first thing, especially I'm thinking like lower levels, elementary school teachers, the first thing that gets taken away from them?
It's the one they like the most, recess all day, right?
We're going to take away your physical activity, something that has been proven to actually help improve the very thing that you're, right? So like we shoot ourselves in the foot on a regular basis. So yeah, that was my riff in the book there. And sunlight is a part of it, but even like smells is a part of it. I remember visiting a school in the Pittsburgh area, and I walked into this one teacher's classroom and I was like, I guarantee she has very little classroom management issues in this class, because everything about that room gave you the sense of this is almost a sacred space when you're walking into it. It was sort of low lights, but then there was like hanging lights, like Christmas lights and stuff. There was some, and there was natural light coming in. There was lots of color and vibrancy around. There was music that was like calm and chill. And there was also essential oils being diffused in the room. Like it was like a whole atmosphere. And so we know that certain things affect us. And we know that all of these different elements enhance our learning or can actually hinder our learning if we sedate students literally. It's going to hinder their learning. I mean, I could say a whole lot more about like, why do we ban chewing of gum when we know that it actually helps with concentration and with easing of anxiety? Oh, because we don't want kids to put gum under the desk. It's like, okay, we can solve that problem differently, going back to design thinking, without stripping away the very thing that is proven as effective for learning. So yeah, lots of things there.
I like that. All right, next you had a phrase called insatiable curiosity. What do you mean by that?
So insatiability, it almost has an erotic connotation. My wife was like, you need to say it like that. But insatiability is like I can't have enough. I got to, like when we talk about like learning becoming addictive, that's I think that if we have a curiosity about people and around their context and about their thinking, like we will ask questions and ask another question and ask another question, because we are really, really, really curious and wanting to understand versus asking questions as a setup in order to argue, right? Like I feel like in so many ways, we even do that, I think, unfortunately, in schools to a fault. We can overbalance on making argumentative papers and argumentative whatever, and I think, well, what if we really just built within our students an insatiable curiosity to seek to understand why? I think Kendrick Lamar, for instance, does some of the best of pushing pause on people and their conclusions that they make and saying, have you considered the things that those people have gone through? Before you're critical about the ways that we live, think about the ways that we cope, is one of his lines, right? So insatiable curiosity really is so deeply interested in others that we ask lots and lots of questions, and those questions produce more questions.
Yeah, when I read that, I connected to the book, How to Talk About Race and Other Things. Mm. And it was really, for me, when somebody does something that upsets you, right? And the book was a lot about race, but it was literally just about like difficult conversations. Yeah. And you keep asking those questions, I think first you emotionally regulate yourself. I think it helps you. D, you come to me and you're like, you yell at me for something that happened in my classroom or something I did. And right away, I'm ready to bite back at you. But instead of letting my emotional regulation go and, let you have it, I start asking, why are you upset? Well, Justin, you didn't put your equipment back after you use it. Well, how did that impact your day? And then the more questions I'm asking, the better understanding I'm getting of what really is ticking you off. And even if something said like that's, let's just say, racist, and you ask the kids, like, one of my favorite things, somebody will say, that's gay, right? You hear that thing, yep. That's gay. And I'll go, so explain to me how this makes, correlates to a man being sexually attracted to another man or a woman being sexually attracted to another woman. And when you put it in those terms, suddenly the kids are like, well, no, I didn't mean it like that. I'm like, well, but that's what you said. Right. Yeah. So again, I love that curiosity.
Okay. This is definitely probably not what you were expecting, but I wanted to take that example that you just used as an opportunity to apologize for something that I said earlier. I caught myself later after I said it and I went, but I can hear the voices of people who are near and dear to me who would say, D, you should know better. And why should I know better? Because they've given me the benefit of letting me know. So I said, I used the word lame, because that was language that my students used to always use, right? Mm-hmm. So then it became a part of my vernacular. And then so now it's part of what I will oftentimes say, and I'll say it in a way of almost like repeating what they would say. And it's like, wait a minute, I know better. And to quote Maya Angelou, once you know better, do better. And so I know better and I didn't do better, but I want to, for any listeners out there who are hearing, know that I caught it later and I apologize and I will do better.
Nice. Appreciate that. Hopefully the listeners will understand that. Yeah, I think sometimes that ableist language sneaks in. Yeah. And we're like, and it's everywhere. And I know people can be like, oh, this woke culture and everything. But it's really about just understanding that with your language, that even if you're not harming somebody, let's say that nobody who had a handicap or any kind of issue took offense to it, right? But what it did is in ourselves, it reinforces the ableism. So it's not even about harming others. It's about getting our own thought processes, right? Mm. Which kind of brings me to the next point. You said the attitude of deep humility acknowledges that we all blemishes and most notably biases that block our ability to see the most marginalized people in our midst and to elevate their voices above our own. For me, this thing about that we all have blemishes, right, actually allows me to go through life, especially in systems, understanding that those who have power over me are not better than me, right? So my principle, while yes, you have the power to write me up, while yes, you have more power to run the school, as a human being first, you're no better than me. I mean, you always hear we put one pant leg on at a time, right? Whatever. You always right. hear that. So I feel like, and people sometimes, I'm like, you'll call the superintendent and say, what? I'm like, Yes, I will do that because, yes, while they have the power, they are not better. I think that's the one thing. And then I think the point you're really getting at, though, is about the biases. Talk to me about these biases that block our ability.
Well, yes. Even hearing it back, I want to concur with the words and that we all have them. And so I have to remind myself of that as well, because there's certain things that, based on my experience and based on my education, I have made certain conclusions, and I feel very strong about them, right? And in that strength of opinion, I can communicate, because it's what's really in my heart. I can communicate like a jerk, right? Like, I don't care what you think. I don't care, like, you're wrong, right? And so having that sort of really strong conflict nature is something that is inherent within me. And a lot of that comes back to what we were even just saying of being unaware. You know, you don't know what you don't know. You don't understand what you don't understand. You don't feel what you've never felt before. And so deep humility is recognizing, it's just giving that as a, it is holding your hands up and saying at the very beginning, I know that I have blind spots. I know that there are things that are part of my entire upbringing and my entire cognitive thinking, part of my culture, that make me believe all of these different things. And then therefore also I think differently than you do, and I may treat you different as a result of those things. And I don't even know what half of them are. That's the worst part. I don't even know what half of them are. And so it requires actually being exposed to others in order to, for some of those things to come out. But yeah, in my book, I lay out a few that in some ways were cherry picked from some larger psychological biases that exist, but they were some of those that I see, you know, very prevalent in education. Dunning-Kruger being one of them. It's you can look up Dunning-Kruger effect, but it's really just the notion of thinking you know more about something that you really know. It's that when you think you understand something and everybody else recognizes just from what you're saying that you don't know what you're talking about, that is Dunning-Kruger effect. There's the halo effect oftentimes, and definitely not thinking of any of people that you were, but I'm thinking about people that I know that I had been connected to, and even myself in certain situations of someone showed and demonstrated excellence in a certain place and a certain thing. And so therefore people think that that excellence travels with them, even if they, we see this all the time. Somebody like moves into a field that's completely different than the field in which they've existed always, right? Like somebody goes from business into, education. It's like, oh, they should be excellent at this. And we hang this halo over them, and we do it almost with permanence because their reputation in a new setting, in a new place, and in new ways, they could be failing miserably, and we're not honest about that. There's a few others, but that gives you bandwagon effect, one that a lot of people are familiar with, right? The most dangerous thing about bias, in my opinion, is that it's beyond just the individual and the one-on-one. It is when it is done as a collective, like how systems of oppression are continued because there are people who will continue to just do what has always been done. And that can be a form of bandwagon effect, right? Well, we've always done it this way, and we're never going to question something, even though we probably should be questioning it. Or should we be questioning decisions that we made more critically, but we have a tendency not to do so because we tend to, give perpetual approval of something that was a decision that we made. So yeah, noticing our bias that goes back to the language from liberatory design, stopping, pausing, noticing your bias at every point. It's a discipline.
Yeah, so you talked about a couple of things. First, the halo effect I think is interesting because like in your family, right, you got people that are financially well off, right? So every family has a cousin, an uncle, somebody who's financially well off, right? For whatever reason. And people in the family think that their word is gospel. And I'm like, listen, you're a doctor. I get it. You know about operating on knees. You know about this. But that doesn't make you an expert on everything. And that's why we give that same credence to like movie stars. Like, yo, that movie star is a human being. That's a person. They didn't spend any more time researching their opinion than you do researching your own dumb opinions. And yet when they say something, the whole world wilds out. But they should know. No, they're a human who is really good at acting in front of a camera. And everything else may or may not be good, depending on how much effort they put into things. So I think those were the couple of the connections that I had right away for that. All right, you ready? We got a couple more. Here we go. Okay. This one, woo, super excited about this one. All right. Dr. Gloria Latsy Billings. And again, people, if you are listening, she's someone, they are someone, I don't even know her pronouns, they are someone who you need to read, right? You need to understand a lot of fantastic thoughts and ideas coming out of that. States that teachers adhere to culturally relevant practices. They have two main qualities: high self-esteem and a high regard for others. Talk to me about this.
That's big. It's so big because it actually ties so tightly to humility, in that humility actually is having a high self-esteem. So we have this misperception oftentimes that to be humble or to exert humility means to think less of yourself, and that's not the case, right? It's not thinking less of yourself. It is posturing yourself. It's actually having enough confidence in yourself and who you are to say, you know what, my opinion and my values don't have to take precedent in this particular setting. And that's powerful in and of itself, to be able to say, you know what, I can lower myself in this setting. And that is, when I say that word, that language of lower, that's all proverbial. That's not, because, it's not having a self-conflated mindset, but it's having enough self-esteem to say, you know what, I recognize I don't lose anything by deferring. I don't lose anything. That's where the self-esteem comes in. And the deferring to others is something that then you can do with a lot more, I don't know if the proper language to use there, but you can do that more simply and easily when you understand you're good. This is now your opportunity to learn with and to help others. Like, this is your opportunity. So, They go hand in hand. You can't have one without the other. If you don't have high self-esteem, then actually you will center more of your thoughts on yourself. You will be more self-conscious about who you are, what you're doing, and how certain things affect you and how other people perceive you. Like, it goes back to that poem, right? You will be incredibly self-centered, so much so that you can't think for others.
I like to think about myself and my teaching and really try to use culturally relevant practices. And I think it's because, like, A, I have supreme confidence in my ability to teach. I work really hard at it. I've studied it. I've honed it. Like, I tell my principal, they go, all right, where do you want to get observed? Just come in. That's literally what I tell them all the time. You pick the class, come in. I don't care. You give me the toughest class. You give me the easiest class. I don't care. And I'm talking behavioral. I don't care at all. Just come in because I know what I'm doing, right? And I've done it so long that I now have a groove. I know that stuff. So for me, I'm not worried about that. And to be honest, your score doesn't really impact my self-esteem anyway for one lesson. So I'm not too worried. But here's the key part. I have such high regard for my students as human beings that first I wanted to learn about them. Like, what are you? Who are you? What makes you tick? And why I boil everything down to the most common of things, right? We all eat. So I love talking about food because that is such a great connection and I can find that culture. Boom, right? We all poop, right? We all pee. So I will always do poop and pee jokes and connections. And people look at me like I'm a juvenile, but what they don't understand is these are commonalities that we are connecting as humans about. So again, I think when we talk about this high regard for others, first, we can learn something from everyone, right? If we really look there. And then if we go back to that insatiable curiosity, I have such a high regard for you that I'm going to give you my energy and I'm going to ask you questions about yourself. I'm going to find out. We're going to talk about music. That's another commonality. So I feel like when I saw that, I go, okay, I get this. I understand this. And again, still working on the culturally relevant practices and fine tuning and honing, trying to figure out, you know, how to connect with all my students. But that one I connected with, which is why I asked you about it. And in here, I think you had a follow-up that says high regard for others is displayed through consistent interaction and inquiry into what they see as your strengths, as well as your flaws, which again, I told you, I have such high regard for my students that I survey them. And if you listen to my podcast or anyone's read a blog, I tell you, if you have power over and you're not surveying power under, then you really don't care about the people. So I always ask them, what do you like about the class? What do you hate about the class? How much do you think Mr. S likes you? Like, I'm going to really try to find out and then use that information to change behaviors.
That's good. Wow, that's good. Man, can I sit in your class one day?
Listen, come hang out, man. It's fun. And there's a reason why when I go into class, people light up, right? Because I work and people don't, again, you got to be what you want to be. Like, so you have to really focus on what you're doing if you want to be a certain thing. And I want to be the teacher that when I walk in, you want to be in that class. So what does that entail? And that's literally how I run my class. And I think too often when people see how I roll in life, they go, oh, that's easy. You know, it takes a lot. What is it? It takes a lot of effort to become an overnight sensation, right? Like you're seeing a final effort. You're seeing the interactions in the hallway. You're seeing, but you don't understand how much work that I put into myself and work that every teacher should put into themselves. All right, next up, here we go. Oh, this is a good one. I think you're going to like this because this one really, really hit hard.
You reminded me of things I wrote, by the way. That's how I'm like, what's coming next? I don't even know.
Love it. Ready for this? The thread and threat of violence runs through all of the isms.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a quote. What's the...
I got to find out the context. I'll see if I can find it because I started. Hold on. Here it is.
Oh, I can't remember if that was
Dr. Beverly Tatum. That's
I was about to say. I couldn't remember if that was Dr. Beverly Tatum or Geneva Gay. Yeah, that was in Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? And there is a short answer right there, right?
100%.
You know? This is somewhat of a tangent on that, but I was recently reviewing the 15 tenets of white supremacy culture and was taken aback again by the first one, the number one one is fear, right? And so if I can create an ethos of fear, then you will do whatever it takes in order to create safety for yourself, right? If fear exists, then safety is its natural response. I need to find safety. And that isn't necessarily through retreat. It could be through counter violence if that is the thing that's being utilized. So when we're talking about any of these issues, I know we're talking about it broadly, but culturally responsive instruction, culturally relevant teaching is around diffusing the fear that exists in settings. And that is not done easily, because it's not just the one-on-one interaction between a teacher and a student. It's the whole history, right? It's recognizing that there's a whole history behind this, and that it takes extra effort to convince those that are within your midst that recognize that you are an authority, that you are not going to wield your power against them. And that's tough. And in some cases, you're a threat just by representation, right? I know that to some of my students, I was a threat just by being a male. That's it. By being a male, I was a threat. You know, race plays a part, of course. There's so many things. And so, and I recognize that my number one goal as an educator is to diffuse the fear, and for that to actually happen, it's going to take a lot of work, depending on the setting and depending on the particular student because of their history. And so there are lots of isms that exist within a context that I am oftentimes a participant in, continuing to perpetuate. But also, I recognize that I can be, that those isms can be placed on me just based on my representation. And it's my job to try and bring those things to the surface and then extract them so that they don't remain. And so, yeah, isms such as ableism, as referred to already, and racism and sexism, just being sort of a big three that exist. But there are lots of isms that exist, and ultimately isms exist in order to perpetuate fear. And fear will continue to perpetuate control. And people will, in different ways, either just cower to it or buck up against it. And education should not be a threatening environment in that way.
It's interesting. I'm always perplexed when someone from a marginalized group hates on another marginalized group. Like, to me, it is one of the most, yeah. So in health, like right now, especially in New Jersey, we just redid our health curriculum standards. So there's a lot more LGBT in there. There's a lot more gender identity, gender expression. And I remember like an Asian lady coming up to me and was like, basically like, we shouldn't be talking about any kind of sexuality in school. And I'm just like, that doesn't make sense to me. Like, you're a marginalized person. You are treated a certain way. And maybe she's in a bubble or whatever, but I'd imagine you understand if you're Asian, what Asian hate looks like in America. I don't think anyone has that. And yet you're hating on another group of people. And one of the things I'm actually trying to dig into is really trying to find Muslim leaders. And I want to talk to Muslim leaders about homophobia and why is it prevalent, and how do, in that culture, we go, well, okay, xenophobia is wrong, or whatever the religious, you know, prejudice is wrong, yet homophobia is okay. Or even talking about it, like, you don't have to agree with things to say there are people out there that exist with these identities and they deserve love and humanity like everyone else. And I use that as one, and that's what I'm trying to get to and bring that to my students.
But so tough. There's a history there.
There's so much, and I get so, religious.
There's also, you know, so much to be said, you know, historically and sociologically around how different marginalized groups have been consistently pitted against one another, right? And so vying for your perceived limited piece of the pie, right, in a zero-sum game, I was just getting mine, and now somebody else is getting it, which means it's being taken away from me. Like or I still haven't got mine, and now you're trying to give it away to someone else, right? Like it continues in so many ways, instead of us having a perspective of this, the sum of us, to quote Heather McGee, and to recognize that we all have something to gain in others gaining. We actually all have something to gain in that regard.
Yeah, which goes to the MLK quote you wrote on here. It says, whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be. This is the interrelated structure of reality. It ties right to that. And I guess for me, like, if you're about equity, equity is access to resources for everyone, right? And I know it's difficult. I always say when you're not part of the marginalized community of whatever identity that is, it's really hard to understand. And I use ableism always as my thing. It's like you look around and most times people walked in to the room that I'm in. They carried whatever bags, computers, whatever, without any help. There's not a sign language person next to us. In most cases, again, I know there's always there. And we don't think about it because most of us have the ability to navigate through life without help. Yet suddenly you break your leg and you become, even for a fraction of time, part of that marginalized community. And now you understand, you know, hey, the world doesn't operate, you know, fairly for everyone.
With me in mind. Yeah.
And I think the hardest part for people like myself, who are white, cisgender, heterosexual males, we're from those dominant majority. So we don't see how other people navigate through life because it hasn't impacted us, which goes back to how do we learn? It's not in books. Is it on podcasts? Well, yeah, because we're doing this, but it's really not a podcast. It's in becoming friends and really living with people. Not specifically because of their identity, but having various identities in your life. And that's really, I think, how we can get rid of that fear that you were talking about before. Like, we all have the same wants and needs. All right, I think I've been in your ear forever. I don't want to take too much more of your time. Let's do closing thoughts, and how can we get a hold of you in life?
Oh, wow. Closing thoughts. This is going to sound very trite, but I am still learning. I am still learning, and I don't want to stop in that learning, but I really think I understand that I am learning. And I say that about life. I say that about the book that I wrote that was painful, by the way, to write over the course of 2 years. And I'm still learning from my experiences, from my exposure to others, and by furthering my education in such a way that I hope to be better at helping others as a result of that. There's so many sort of very influential pieces that I feel like I was blessed by that I put in the book. One of them was Dr. Geneva Gay giving the distinction between caring for and caring about people. And, you know, caring about people is more akin to sympathy, right? It's legit. It's legitimately caring about someone, wishing that they didn't hurt. But caring for someone is really putting that verb to love and saying, okay, I would take this to the next step of actually providing help and service to the person who is hurting. And that's stretching beyond empathy to compassion. I believe that is what we are really after in education, is to create future leaders that are compassionate in what they do. And I just hope that we get better at that. In particular, as the stakes get higher and everything becomes around competitiveness and around advantages and around high stakes that go to funding, and then we do all the things that really become a weeding out process to, again, others to get power and others to never have a piece of it or a place in society that allows them to live comfortably. So I want to push educators, and I want myself to continue to be pushed to that end. And how you can find me? I'm most accessible on Twitter at DeLanier, DeLanier. It's my name. So at me on Twitter. That's where I'm most accessible. I have a couple of websites and Linktree and all that sort of stuff. But if you, I don't say this as a brag, but literally if you're like, I forgot where to find that dude, or I forgot the title of his book, or I forgot the whatever. I worked hard, speaking about being a classroom teacher, I worked hard to up my social profile because there were some things that I was not originally excited about that was on the internet concerning me. And so it was something that I taught my students to try and up their game in. And I think I've worked pretty hard to up my own. So literally just Google me, and there are multiple ways to find me, and I will holler back. And Justin, biggest final thought. I want to at least remotely, at very least, join your room and co-facilitate some solving time if you let me.
Dude, I love it, because I literally went to the website, because again, this design thinking it's a lot. And you know, I'm trying to figure out, and I always do this, like, how do I bring this to my world? How do I bring it to health? How do I bring it to phys ed? And I need to tie it to what the standards are that I'm teaching, and not like a specific standard, but the idea of how does this impact movement, or how is this impacting wellness, like some general broad idea. And I feel like I'm not ready for the big, right? I'm not ready for the Christy Kate. I need the little one. And I feel like that's where this website that you got, you know, will do. So give me like a chance to look at it. I'm going to bring it in. And then it's something I think sixth graders would absolutely dig. And if nothing else, if everything fails and they don't do anything, it's learning something new. It's something novel. And anytime we bring novelty in the classroom, bring another way for them to learn, bring in outside people, you know, that's a victory for everyone in and of itself.
Let's go. We could pick one topic that you feel that you have a high level of confidence. These kids, they'll get this topic. We don't have to try and exhaust ourselves in defining it and making them personalize it. Let's start with some low-hanging fruit, and then we'll give them the opportunity to consider in small groups how that problem either affects them, affects, you know, someone they know and or care about, or maybe even a stranger, and then they can take that as perspective and then go down a line of research, understanding, solving, and then sharing, and we'll all benefit from it. So I am volunteering myself to be in your classroom if you allow me.
All right. I like it. As soon as this ends, I will be setting this up. All right, people. Hopefully everyone has a good morning, afternoon, evening, whatever it is. Peace.